WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Sunday night, Masterpiece Theater will present a BBC production of A Doll's House, Ibsen's proto-feminist drama. My guest, Juliet Stevenson, stars as Nora. Americans haven't seen much of Stevenson yet, but I think most of us who saw her in the film Truly, Madly, Deeply were hoping to see her again soon. The New Yorker film critic Terence Rafferty called her performance remarkable. In England, Juliet Stevenson is best known for her performances with the Royal Shakespeare Company. She also starred in the original British production of Les Liaisons Dangereuses and is now starring in the British production of Death and the Maiden. Here she is with actor Trevor Eve in a scene from the conclusion of A Doll's House when Nora has her awakening.
When I lived at home with Papa, he used to tell me what he thought about everything, and so I thought the same. Or if I didn't, I used to hide it, because he wouldn't have liked it. He called me his doll child, and he used to play with me the way I played with my dolls. And then I came to live in your house.
What a way to talk about our marriage.
What I mean is that I passed from Papa's hands and into yours. You arranged everything according to your taste, and so it became my taste too. Or I pretended it did. I don't really know which. Or both, I think. First one, and then the other. Looking at it now, I think I have lived here like a pauper. From hand to mouth. I've lived by performing tricks for you, Torvald, because that's the way you wanted it. You and Papa have done me a great wrong. It's because of both of you that I've made nothing of my life.
How unreasonable and ungrateful can you be? I mean, haven't you been happy here?
No. I've never been that. I thought I was.
Not.
But I never really have been.
Not happy?
No. Just cheerful. And you've always been so kind to me, Torvald. But our home has never been more than a doll's house. I've been your doll wife here, just as I was Papa's doll child at home. And the children have been my dolls in their turn. I thought it was fun when you played with me, just as they thought it was fun when I played with them. That's been our marriage, Torvald.
Is there a part of A Doll's House that you find most personally affecting?
I suppose one of the things that I've felt most is kind of most moving about Nora in a way is that she thinks she's happy, but she never has been. I mean, she's incredibly energetic, full of optimism and buoyancy and positive thinking, you know, for most of the play. Increasingly, obviously, under duress as events take place and she's under greater and greater pressure. But the tragedy, in a way, is that she has constructed her entire life up to that point upon a lie. You know, and I think that's a way in which, I mean, that says a lot about many marriages, I think, that actually there's a level at which each partner in the marriage colludes with a way of life or a conviction about the other person, which is not really who they are. And the tragedy the doll has is not that she leaves or anything like that, but I think that she, you know, at the very end, she discovers that everything that she pinned her hopes on, every belief that she had about him and what they could be for each other, was completely misconceived.
A Doll's House is one of the things that makes A Doll's House exceptional is that it's a play that has a kind of feminist understanding, even though it's from before a feminist period. But you've done a lot of classic drama over the years, and most of the now classics were written by men long before feminism. So there's not just a shortage of good roles, but what are the roles like? Do you know? I mean, do you find enough roles that you really feel comfortable playing?
Well, that's the struggle. That's the challenge, to find those roles. I mean, I've had a very lucky time recently because I've been doing a wonderful play here in London, you know, that's just opened on Broadway, Death and the Maiden. And that's a phenomenal role because it's a character who the writer allows to go in every conceivable direction, however unacceptable. It's very difficult to find roles where you can be really unacceptable. You know, very often women's roles are those of women who are somebody's girlfriend or wife or lover or daughter, who you're squeezed into a shape which feels lesser than your own size. And I'm not talking about me, I'm just talking about most women, you know. So it's wonderful. Recently, I feel I've had a real sort of run of luck because I've been able to play women who you can take in many different directions, you know, with whom you have a lot of rope, as it were, as an actress. And the great, great thing about Ibsen is that he conceived of women and wrote for them in a way in which you have enormous range and scope to play with. And, I mean, he did that probably better than many people have done since.
The first time I saw you in a performance, I'll confess, was just a couple of months ago in a screening of Truly, Madly, Deeply. And you played a woman whose husband recently died, and you miss him so much that you're unable to go on with life. He comes back as a ghost, moves into the house, and becomes something of a pain in the neck. And the movie's both very moving and very funny. There's a scene early on in the film in which you're in your psychiatrist's office explaining how much you miss your dead husband, and you're crying. And I was so moved by that scene. I thought it was one of the most realistic crying scenes I'd ever seen in a film. And I'd love to hear you talk about how, what you did in that scene.
I don't really remember. I think acting in a way is like, you know, you have to perform sort of daylight raids on your own life, you know. I think there are many different kinds of actor, and people work in very different ways, but I suppose I've always felt it's sort of what I do with who I am, you know, through the skin of somebody else, you know. I wouldn't want to tell my own story, but I like telling other people's stories. But the raw material, the tools of the trade, as it were, are you and your makeup, as it were, and your experience and stuff. And so there are times when you've got to do something which is a bit challenging or difficult like that, when you really just have to kind of dig a hole for yourself, metaphorically, and slide down into it and stay there, you know. And so it's I don't enjoy those things very much. But I was very lucky. I had the most wonderful team, and that's, I mean, 50% of it, because you can be acting your socks off, of course, but if they don't get it right, you know, if the technical team don't get it right, you're stumped. And I had a wonderful director, you know, Anthony Minghella, and a wonderful cameraman and crew and so on, who were really sympathetic and very sort of understanding about the actor's requirements in the film, and really did everything they could to get it in the can when it was at its best or freshest or whatever, to minimise the number of retakes and for difficult stuff. And so I was very blessed in that way, which was 50% of it, you know.
Now, in England, you've been playing in a production of Death and the Maiden, which is a play by Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman about a woman who was tortured in a Latin American country, then finds the man she believes was the torturer and wants to punish him. The show recently opened on Broadway in a production directed by Mike Nichols, starring Glenn Close, Richard Dreyfuss, and Gene Hackman. Now, in America, there were protests by Latino actors that whites were being chosen for Latino roles, and I was wondering if there's any similar sentiments in England.
No, there hasn't been anything like that at all, but then we don't really have a Latino contingent, really, in the acting profession at all, to speak of. I mean, there's only a tiny handful of Latin American actors here. But the issue's never really come up. I mean, I think it would be different if we were doing a play, you know, set in the West Indies or set in part of India or Pakistan, because we have large West Indian and Asian population here, but we don't have a big Latin American population here, and certainly very, very few members of Equity are. So that hasn't arisen. No. Also, I think because we're English, I don't think, I mean, clearly we're not anything like Latin Americans, and although we've made some concessions to it, because Ariel Dorfman's always insisted that the play is not set in Chile, nor is it about Chile, but it should be set anywhere in the world, China, South Africa, you know, it has resonance for so many places. The whole issue of who should be doing it or whatever has never really arisen.
Did you originate the role? Was it the first production?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you asked to be in the Broadway production?
Yes.
And what happened?
American Equity wouldn't allow it, wouldn't let me through.
Oh, because they wanted the role to go to an American actor.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Things are a bit sort of, I was disappointed at the time, of course, personally. And I rather regret, I mean, I think it happened in the wake of the whole business with Jonathan Pryce and Miss Saigon on Broadway, and the fact that American Equity had stopped him coming as well, and then that Cameron McIntosh, you know, pulled the show out, which had a multi-million dollar advance, so they stood to lose a massive amount of money, so Equity then climbed down, and Jonathan Pryce did do the show, of course, and I think that was probably publicly very difficult for Equity to deal with, because it was sort of a bit humiliating. And I think I was probably the first Brit to come along after that, you know, and so no doubt they thought, well, this time we're really gonna stick to our guns. But I was disappointed, I was, for a few days when it happened, because the level at which the two unions argue with each other about these things is incredibly banal and very pedantic. And I, in an ideal world, I think the arts are not about that. I mean, I hate the idea of stopping in one musician playing in another, you know. The arts are supposed to cross-fertilise. I spent 6 months with John Malkovich here in the West End last year, year before.
Oh, doing Burn This?
And doing Burn This, and there were four in the cast, and him and another American actor came over. And it never occurred to me they shouldn't be there, and I loved working with them because I learned a lot. I had to throw a lot of my own rules away. I had to negotiate how to work with people from a very different tradition. And I learned, and maybe I hope they learned something too from working with us. And that's very rich, you know, because then you grow and you... That's the way the arts have always worked, you know. Music changes and develops as it crosses cultures and is influenced by other indigenous musicians, and art the same. And so on a wider level, I really regret the very sort of chauvinistic, self-protective instincts of both English and American equity. I understand, of course, that there's a recession in both our countries, and so, you know, they're going to be more protective. But in the end, it's... I'm not sure who it does protect. I honestly think that if you tried an experiment and opened the doors tomorrow, you know, between America and England, in terms of actors being able to work in each other's countries, I don't think anybody would suffer. I think they'd only gain from it, really.
You know, it seems that Mike Nichols ended up taking a completely different direction afterwards. And what I mean by that is that all of the three actors are very well-known movie stars, Gene Hackman, Richard Dreyfuss, Glenn Close. Which isn't to take away, I don't mean to say that they're not capable of performing well on stage, but they're names that are very well known to just about all American moviegoers, whereas you are not as yet that well known in America. I mean, it seems to be part of a trend where more and more American theater is going toward big name stars.
Yes. Well, maybe it's a facet of times being tough or something. I mean, it sounds to me, I don't know much about this, but it does sound that the whole business of mounting a Broadway show is now so incredibly risky and so incredibly expensive. I mean, when I tell you that the set for the Broadway production, I think, cost, a phenomenal amount of money, more money than it takes to mount six productions at the Royal Court here, infinitely more. I mean... The scale of expenditure is so vast now, it seems, in terms of production values and so on, that presumably they can take fewer risks, so they try and put in, I suppose, people who are going to be guaranteed to put a lot of bums on a lot of seats, which is, I think it's fine. I mean, it's one way, you know, it's one aspect of theatre, but I think it's something to be a little vigilant about, because people go into the theatre to see very famous people perform. Does have an influence on the relationship they have to the evening.
What do you mean?
You know. Well, in the end, a play is a collective, collaborative act. The putting on of a play is a collaborative activity, and the focus of everybody's attention should be the play. You know, you can be as virtuosic as you like, but I think you have to harness yourself to the event of doing this play if you believe in it. And I think if people are coming along simply because they want to see movie stars in the flesh, then they... That's a different kind of audience, you know, and it can affect the power of the evening. It can undermine the power of the play, I think, if you... I don't know what's happened. I'm certainly not assuming that this has happened with the current Broadway production of Death and the Maiden. I'm sure it hasn't, because those are three very fine actors we're talking about. Really wonderful actors.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're real actors. I mean, I think it just gets a bit dodgy when you have people who are film stars but not good actors, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, obviously, at some level, the play is not served as well, perhaps.
If you're just joining us, my guest is British actress Juliet Stevenson, who stars this Sunday night in a Masterpiece Theatre production of A Doll's House. It's actually a BBC production, but you can see it on PBS on Masterpiece Theatre. It's this Sunday at 9. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actress Juliet Stevenson is my guest. You know, one of the differences, it seems to me, between England and America now for actresses is I think that American movies are just much more vigilant at weeding out people who don't conform to what perfect-looking is considered to be for the moment. As a matter of fact, even perfect-looking actresses have to get plastic surgery now to make themselves slightly more perfect. But that doesn't seem to be happening, at least certainly not to the same extent in England. What do you think?
I think that's true, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Hollywood's imperatives in terms of what people have to look like are have always been pretty pretty limited, haven't they, in terms of, you know, there's one rule for guys, certainly, and there's another rule for women.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
If you look at Richard Dreyfuss and Gene Hackman, for example, you know, with great respect, they're not kind of traditionally very beautiful-looking people, but they've got wonderful faces.
Right.
I think it's an area where it's much easier for a man, if he's a very good actor, to sustain a career as a film actor as well, even though he may not look like a male model, whereas it is harder for women. And obviously that has some truth here too, but not anything like the same extent. But then our business isn't dominated by a large film industry. God knows.
Right. you know what I find? I really don't mind. I mean, I enjoy a glamorous actress in a glamorous role. What bugs me is a glamorous actress in a role of a plain person, and somehow we're supposed to be convinced that this person is plain and that a kind of regular human being looking actress wouldn't be good enough to play the plain person. You know, they have to be glamorous to play her.
Mm. Call me old-fashioned. I think you should look like the character you're playing. You know?
Right.
I mean, that's the sort of center of my preoccupation is how to look like the person that I'm playing.
Right, right. And look glamorous when that's appropriate and look more plain when
and
that's
not
appropriate.
And not if it's not.
Yeah, Are you interested in making American movies, and do you see a place for yourself in American films as an English actress?
I never have done. I mean, Truly Madly Deeply had a very warm response from the film industry in LA, which was lovely, and I've been out there about 4 times in the last year or so for various reasons. And so a few doors have opened up, as they say. But I don't know. It would be very nice if it happened. But I certainly wouldn't move out there or put a lot of store by it happening because, I'd love to do some more filming, and we have such a sort of embattled film industry here, and there's so few movies made here that it is very difficult to keep filming here, as it were, because there's so little going on. So I'd welcome any opportunities that came from America, you know, but it would depend what it was. I mean, the thing that's always guided me is what interests me. What is the interesting material? That's how I make choices about work. So if in the hypothetical event of something coming from America, if it wasn't something which I felt I could connect with, then I wouldn't really want to do it. Do you know what I mean? It's not for the sake of it.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be for the sake of it that I did it. But it's not very likely anyway, I don't think. So this is hypothesis. But, I mean, I have been, there was sort of quite a lot of pressure last year to go out there and sit around a bit and wait for things to happen and, you know, strike while the iron was hot and all that. But this play came up and I just couldn't resist doing it because it's a wonderful play, wonderful role. And that's really the way I've always done things. I wouldn't want to turn something down that I felt passionate about in order to go and hang around waiting for something nebulous, as it were. But I would be very happy if something came through that I really wanted to do. Be great.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Juliet Stevenson stars in Henrik Ibsen's A Doll's House this Sunday night on Public TV's Masterpiece Theatre. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London.